The views and opinions expressed here are those of the guests, and are not the official position of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. In 1915, newlyweds Willard and Rebecca Bean moved into the Joseph Smith home in Palmyra, New York. Their mission was to last 5 years, stretched into 25. Overcoming hatred and bigotry, the family became respected, loved, and finally honored as the most versatile family to ever live in Palmyra. In studio with me today are two of Willard and Rebecca's grandchildren. First, a granddaughter, Vicky Bean Topliff. Vicky is the daughter of Willard and Rebecca Bean's second child, Alvin Bean. For years, Vicky collected all she could find about her grandparents, Willard's life story, missionary journals, letters, newspaper articles, as well as the four books he wrote during his 25-year mission in Palmyra. In 1980, she compiled a 106-page book entitled Willard Bean, The Fighting Parson. By 2005, after several more years of research, she compiled what she refers to as the complete life and works of Willard Bean, which turned into a two-volume set consisting of 830 pages and hundreds of pictures. Wow. Vicky and her husband Ed live in Orem, Utah. She raised seven children in Huntington Beach, California, prior to moving to Utah in 1996. She's now the ecstatically happy grandmother of 23, with number 24 due any minute. Vicky, thank you for being here. Also joining us is Rand Packer, son of Willard and Rebecca's oldest child and only daughter, Palmyra. As a young boy, Rand often spent time with his grandparents. It was from them and from his mother, Palmyra, that he nourished an avid interest in the history and happenings of the restoration of the gospel in the land of Comorah. Following his mission in New Zealand, he pursued a 36-year career in the church educational system. During that time, he received a Master of Arts degree from Brigham Young University in LDS Church History and Doctrine, writing a thesis on four Mormon landmarks in Western New York. Rand and his wife, Shirley, are the parents of nine children. Thank you, Rand, for being here. Let's start with you, Vicky. Can you give us a quick background on the Smith Farm and how the church came to purchase it?
Sure. I think that there were seven or eight different families that lived in the Smith home up until William Avery Chapman moved in. And in the early 1900s, George Albert Smith would go back there quite often, hoping to make friends with the Chapman family, hoping to then be able to purchase the home for the church. In 1907, that dream was realized, and Chapman's agreed to sell the home, with just one stipulation that they could stay there until they found another suitable place to live, and that took another 7 years. So it wasn't until 1914 that the church actually got possession of the home. My grandparents, Willard and Rebecca Bean, got married in September in the Manti Temple, and a couple of months later there was a conference in Richfield, and they went to that conference. The president of the church at that time was Joseph F. Smith, and he was conducting the conference. He had realized once they got possession of the home that he needed to come up with somebody to go back there and live in that home. And he said he needed somebody who could farm the land, somebody who had who knew the gospel very well, who knew the scriptures very well, somebody who was friendly and could make friends with the people and hopefully eventually maybe form a branch of the church back there. So at this conference, Grandma was sitting up in the choir loft, and Grandpa walked in the side door. And when he did, President Smith stood up and he said, "Would Willard Bean please come to the stand?" And Grandpa went up there and he said, "I've got another mission for you, and I'd like to talk to you and your wife after this meeting." So after the meeting, they did go and talk to him. And he said that when Willard walked in that door, he said the impression was so strong that it was like a voice said to him, "There's your man." So they were called to go back and live in the Joseph Smith home. They were told it would be for 5 years or more, which we know turned out to be significantly more. They were also told that that it would be the most prejudiced place in the world. They would find it the people not to be terribly friendly there. They certainly did learn that. They said that when people were just walking their dogs down the street, they would pull them to the other side so they wouldn't come in any contact with the Mormons. They would scream obscenities and go by their house, you know, throwing things and screaming at them, saying to go back to Utah where they belonged. They didn't want any Mormons there. Even when they went to buy groceries, the people wouldn't wait on them, so they had to go to neighboring towns just to buy food. So it did turn out to be just as prejudiced and difficult as the prophet had told them that it would be.
So getting back to his call, how did they know they could trust Willard Bean to have this position?
I would say because of his background already. He was born in Provo. When he was 18, he was asked to be the driver and camp caretaker for the presiding bishopric when they went down to Mexico to visit the saints. And that trip lasted about a year. And he used to say that he would, roll out his sleeping bag with these men and eat around the campfire with them. And I think that particular time given to him that year, he really gained a strong testimony of the gospel. And then he was called on a mission to the Manti Temple at one point, and he lived in the temple with President Wells. And again, that would have lasted at least a year, but President Wells wasn't well, and so he stayed there. And my guess is that he probably really learned the scriptures at that time. I think he studied the scriptures like crazy. George Albert Smith once said of him, he knows of no man in the church who could quote as much scripture as Willard Bean. So he had that experience, and then he was called on a full-time mission to the southern states, to Tennessee. So he'd had a plenty of church experience, and the brethren could have kept an eye on him all that time. I think he was well prepared to go back to this prejudiced place.
So he had ample opportunity to mingle with the general authorities of the church through these various things that he did, and so that's how they knew that they could trust him. Yeah. Excellent. Rand, your mother, Palmyra, was the first child born to Willard and Rebecca.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
They were expecting Palmyra when they arrived in Palmyra in February of 1915. And as the time approached for Palmyra to be born in August, nearly a soul would come and help. Rebecca was concerned because this was her first child. And not having had the experience before, wondering who would help her and who might assist her in the birth of her child. Willard had given assistance in the birth of animals before, and he was very much prepared to help her, but that's not too much of a comfort to a young mother who's having her first child. She prayed and prayed for someone to help her. And she would ask people, and they would turn her down. They did not even want to come into a Mormon home. It was just not something that was that they wanted to do. They did not like the Mormons, and the Mormons could fare for themselves. They didn't want them there, and so Rebecca was left alone to give birth to this child until a knock came at the door, and a young lady introduced herself and said, "I understand that you're in need of someone to come and assist you in the birth of your child." She says, "I am not afraid to come into a Mormon home. And I know the things that they're saying about the Mormons aren't true because my brother was interested and fascinated with the Mormon church, so much so that he went to Salt Lake City to find out for himself what the Mormons were like. And he wrote back and said to me that all the things that were being said about the Mormons were not true, that they were wonderful people and nice people. And so I'm here, and I'm not a professional nurse, but I've been involved in situations like this, and I can be of assistance if you'd like me to." And so Rebecca was just overjoyed with the opportunity of someone to come and help her give birth to her first child. And her name, Ethel Hack. And she went home, got her clothes, packed her little bag, came back to the Smith home, and spent the next 3 weeks there in the Smith home assisting Rebecca before and after the birth of her child until Rebecca was on her feet and could manage by herself. And then she left. And so Rebecca testifies that the Lord answered her prayers and someone came to assist her in this moment of need, a very special, sensitive time, and one which is happy to consider as we understand this story.
What a beautiful story, and how the Lord can prepare situations how he so chooses. It's amazing. The name Palmyra, it's a beautiful name, and one, of course, steeped in church history. Can you tell me a little bit more why they decided to name their daughter Palmyra?
Well, a great amount of prejudice, as Vicki has mentioned, and dislike for the Mormons as the church came back in the early 1900s. And Willard, always looking for opportunities to share the gospel and to make friends with those that aren't particularly friendly with the church. And I'm sure as they discussed many names as to what they would name their child, both boy names and girl names, in the discussion and in the final decision, they decided to name her after the city now that they were living in, the city of Palmyra, New York. I'm sure there was some ridicule within it, but most people, I'm sure there in Palmyra, thought, you know, I wonder why we never thought of naming one of our children Palmyra. And it was a great tribute to that city and a great tribute to the people of Palmyra. And I am sure helped break down a few barriers, is what they were trying to do anyway in the first place as they made their way there in Palmyra. And the fact of naming one of their children after the city where these people were living and had lived for a long time, I think was a pleasant surprise to the community of Palmyra.
I kind of wondered if that was probably the case. And so, Vicki.
Well, let me mention how my father got his name. He was the second child born. They named him Alvin Pliny Bean. They named him Alvin after the prophet's brother, and Pliny was the name of the man who owned the Hill Cumorah, Pliny Sexton. So they always called him Pliny while he lived back there. When Dad went in the Army, his name was kind of changed to Alvin, and he went by Alvin all of his adult years. But Dad said that he thinks that they probably called him Pliny when he was little, hoping that that would kind of soften the heart of Pliny Sexton, who owned the hill. And, of course, they were interested in purchasing the Hill Cumorah. And they did become really good friends, but Pliny Sexton isn't the one who sold them the hill, but it had to come after his death. Nonetheless, they were thinking all the time about
just how they
the
could
names
have,
of the children.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I never knew him as Alvin. I always called him Uncle Pliny.
Very interesting.
In my growing up, yeah.
Yeah, when people call him Pliny, I know they go way back when they use that name with me.
You brought up the Hill Cumorah. Rand, can you tell us the story of the first time that your grandparents visited the Hill Cumorah and what happened then?
Shortly after they arrived in Palmyra, one of the first things they wanted to do because of the import of the Hill Cumorah in church history was to visit the hill. And so shortly after their arrival, they got into their buggy, Willard and Rebecca, and rode out to the Hill Cumorah. And it looks much different then, of course, most of the trees being gone and it being turned into a grazing hill by those who had owned the Hill Cumorah. And they got out of their buggy and made an attempt to climb the Hill Cumorah. As soon as they started, a man started yelling at them from across the field and running towards them. And as he approached, they could see that he had a shotgun in his hands and was yelling at them and demanding that they not set foot upon the Hill Cumorah. Willard said, "Oh, we just want to climb the hill. We just like to climb to the top of the hill." He said, "Are you some of the Mormons? Are you the Mormons that moved into the new Joseph Smith home?" And he said, "We are. We're Willard and Rebecca Bean." And he said, "There are no Mormons that are going to climb this hill." And he demanded that they leave. And Willard helped Rebecca back into the buggy, and knowing that buckshot was a little more powerful than skin, and he was not at that particular moment ready to take on that conflict, but they got back in and rode back to the Joseph Smith farm, waiting for another time wherein they would be able to climb the Hill Cumorah, which came pretty soon.
So early on, they found it was true that the prejudice was very evident. And there are a few other stories that tell exactly what they were facing. There was one of a group of ministers coming over to the house when Willard was gone. Rebecca, Vicki, can you tell me about that story?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember when we tell the story that how old Grandma was. She was 23 when she married Grandpa. He was 46. He'd lived a lot of life and experienced a lot of things. She was still a really young girl. And so I'm sure that this prejudice and criticism was extremely difficult for her. I think in that day and time, too, it's not like she could call home and talk to Mom and, you know, cry on somebody's shoulder. So she really didn't like it when people came to the door when Grandpa was not there. And this particular day, he was in town, and she was sitting. By this time, she had had her baby, Palmyra, and she was sitting in a rocking chair with her, and she heard this knocking on the door. And she thought, well, you know, maybe if I'm real quiet, they'll just go away. I think nobody's home. But that didn't happen. They knocked and pounded, and finally she decided she'd better answer the door. So she did, and she said there were several people on the porch, and they said that they had just come from a ministerial convention, and they had passed Mormon Hill, which is what they called the Hill Cumorah, and they thought they'd come by and learn a little about old Joe Smith. She said later that she always wondered why they referred to him as old Joe Smith when he was such a young man, but she figured they just, you know, felt they were insulting him more by referring to him that way. Well, they came in the house, and she said they just started screaming questions at her, never giving her a chance to answer them. And she said that the mood was just so terrible. And she said, I felt like I needed to pray, but I didn't know how I could. And she said, but then she said, deep down in my heart, I did pray. And she said, all of a sudden, there was this haze in the room. And she said, I felt that someone was standing beside me. And she said, after that, I knew the prophet Joseph Smith. She said, the people all of a sudden got quiet, and they let me answer their questions. And I took them upstairs and showed them the prophet's bedroom, and we went back downstairs. And some of them, she said, apologized to me for how rude they had been. And some of them signed the guest book there that they had their visitors sign. And she said, then they went out, and I sat back down with my baby. And she said she had, the baby had been crying naturally when all the screaming was going on, but the baby had now calmed down. And she said, I sat down and reflected on what had just happened. And she said, from then on, I felt the presence of Joseph Smith all the time we lived there. And she said, my family felt it too. She said that the children could, at a very young age, could go out and take people through the house. They could take them through the grove. They could take them to the Hill Cumorah, and they could tell them all the things that happened there at very young ages. In fact, my dad told me, he was probably about 5 at the time, and he was showing some people around, and he said sometimes they would give him a little money for showing them around. And in this particular occasion, a man handed him a nickel, and he asked if he could have a dime instead of a nickel because he didn't know how to take 10% of a nickel. So he learned very young how to work that side of things as well, you know. But they for me too, you know, having grown up then with my father and with these stories and with Aunt Pal, and that was their life. You know, the church was their life, and Joseph Smith was part of their life, and consequently he's part of my life, and it's been a real good experience for me too.
As perhaps another example of some of the prejudice they faced, can you tell us a little bit about your dad's first day of school?
Yes. He started school at the age of 6, and when he got there, his teacher escorted him to a desk that had been screwed to the back, to the floor of the back corner of the room, and that had been necessary because the children had all brought notes from their parents saying they were not to sit by that Mormon boy. So I asked Dad how he felt about that as a little kid, and he didn't remember it being too disturbing to him. He said, I think, in fact, that it was probably more embarrassing to the teacher than it was to me, because probably a couple of weeks later, he went in and found his desk back in the row where it belonged. But that didn't mean that the kids quit harassing them. You know, he said they'd steal their lunches and they'd hide their galoshes and things like that. They had to deal with that for many years.
Rand, there is one other little persecution story I think you wanted to share with us.
After they'd arrived and been there for a short time, knock came at the door of the Smith home. And Willard opened it and introduced himself as Willard Bean and invited three gentlemen to come in. They very abruptly said, no, Mr. Bean, we won't come in, but we'd like you to come outside. So Willard opened the screen door, walked out on the veranda there at the Smith home, and they immediately indicated to him that they had been in a meeting with the citizens of Palmyra, had just come from the meeting, and that all of the citizens of Palmyra agreed that they did not want the Bean family there or any Mormons there and demanded that they leave Palmyra. Well, Willard was born for moments like this. He loved defending the church, and he was not afraid of anyone. So he thought for a minute and then said something like this. Out of his autobiography, he indicates that he said, I'm sorry to hear that, gentlemen. We had hoped to come out here and to be a part of this community and make a contribution to the citizenry of this community. But we will not be driven out. We were driven out of Palmyra many years ago, and we will not be driven out again. Even if we have to fight our way in, we will stay. And I will take you on one at a time or three at a time, whatever you like. He then put himself in his boxing mode, his boxing stance, and the three gentlemen looked at each other and quickly exited and headed north to Palmyra. And that was probably a good thing for them because Willard Bean was a professional boxer and he knew how to handle himself with his fists if he needed to. And so they left, and that little incident no longer existed. They were there to stay, and they were going to stay and not be driven out.
One other humorous story about Willard walking along the street and getting sprayed by a hose. You want to share that one with us, Rand?
Yes, this one has been told in General Conference, and it's been in the Ensign and lots of different articles written. So wonderful story of him walking down the streets of Palmyra and a man watering his yard, his lawn, and sees Willard, knowing who he is, and decides to shower him with the hose and to drench him with the hose as he walks by, saying to Willard, as this is all unfolding, understand, believe by baptism, by immersion. And Willard hopped the little fence there and went over to where he was holding the hose and grabbed him, the story says, and had the man cowering beneath him. And Willard says, yes, and we also believe in the laying on of hands. And we don't know exactly what happened after that, but that is the story that is told. And we can all see Willard doing that in quite a fit of not only firmness, but also of enjoyment in doing something like that as he confronted this situation.
So he probably didn't hurt anybody, but
I don't think so.
Made sure he knew that
right.
He probably could.
And Aunt Pal said that she thinks he is one who ultimately joined the church,
right,
as I recall. Yeah.
If we can backtrack just for a second, Vicki, can you tell us a little bit about his Southern States mission and maybe some of the boxing exploits that happened during that time?
I can, and I'm sure Rand can too. But let me just say a few things. When he was called on that mission to the Southern States, he was called to replace two missionaries who had been shot and killed, along with some Mormon family that they were teaching. So he knew that he was going into a very prejudiced territory, you know, where they didn't like Mormons at all. So that's why by the time he got to Palmyra, he was very used to this kind of thing. I know when they got there, and by the way, Hosea Stout was one of his companions, as was George Albert Smith, and the mission president was J. Golden Kimball. Anyway, as they would walk along, they would see posters, you know, nailed to trees saying, Mormons, get out of town, get out of the country or be killed. Well, they had to know that possibly those were real since they had already killed some Mormon missionaries. But Grandpa's approach to that was to nail, you know, posters on top of theirs just saying, we're here to stay, basically, and we're willing to teach to preach the gospel anywhere, anytime. So I will tell one story. I'm not sure what stories Rand has in mind, but I'm sure, you know, there are plenty. But one time he and his companion walked into the town center and asked for a drink of water. And he said, we were immediately recognized by our clergy garb, whatever that might have been, but they could tell that they were Mormon missionaries. And so they were denied a drink of water. So they decided, well, we'll go ahead and pass out these pamphlets anyway. So there was quite a little group gathering. And then this really big guy, probably 6'5", Grandpa, by the way, was probably maybe 5'10", 5'11", not real tall, but this guy towered over him, and he brought a couple of his buddies with him and was saying that, boy, now my mind's going to go blank on this. I guess he just wanted to fight Grandpa. Grandpa said, well, I tell you what, let's just make this a sporting deal, just you and me. And he said, if I whip you, we get to preach. If you whip me, then you get to whip us. You know, this poor missionary companion standing next to him probably didn't know what was up. Anyway, it didn't take Grandpa but one swing, I think, to flatten this guy. And he was down on the ground, and there was a man standing there who, I guess, owned the schoolhouse nearby. And he said, you can use my schoolhouse any time to preach. And about this time, this guy's coming too, I think, and standing up. And he said, and me and my boys will see that it's packed every night. And they did. So that was sometimes is a very positive outcome with Grandpa and his shenanigans, shall we say.
In that particular story, one of the fun, out of his autobiography, he says he puts his Bible and his Book of Mormon on the tree stump, and he says, lay there, religion, while I prepare this man for Mormonism. And then proceeded to, as Vicki mentions, to put him on the ground very quickly. A lot of stories of his boxing prowess, and the Lord has such an interesting way of preparing people for different particular missions and different situations in the church, of which he did, I'm sure, with Willard and Rebecca. And this particular area needed someone who was able to defend himself and defend the church, and he'd been doing it all of his life on his mission. When he is enters and J. Golden Kimball interviews him, and he says, Willard, you've been a fighter all of your life. You're just going to have to learn to turn the other cheek. And Willard looks back at him and says, I'll be happy to turn the other cheek if he can hit the first one. And he just was always anxious to defend the Lord and defend the kingdom and to stand up for the church any opportunity he had. One particular time in the mission field, he was in a home. The man demanded that he get off his property. Willard's companion was out on the road across the street, didn't come in the house, just Willard was there, and demanded that Willard leave the property immediately. And Willard said, okay, if that's the way you're going to be. And he just kind of meandered his way across the room and just took very slow time in getting to the door, which made the man very upset. And the man again demanded him to leave, and Willard said, you have anger in your heart, and you're not going to feel better until you take care of that. And immediately the man charged him, and Willard sidestepped him, and just in a minute Willard had him down on the floor and gave him, according to LeGrand Richards, who told this story at his funeral, had him down on the ground and gave the man a real spanking. And they got up, and the man said, no one has ever done that before to me. And Willard said, well, I just did it. And he said, have you had supper? Willard said, no, I haven't. He says, will you stay and eat with me? And he said, my companion's out on the road. Can he come in too? And he said, yeah, call him. So he calls his companion. He comes in, and they sit down and have a nice meal with this man. And the story is that the man later went on and joined the church, because Willard was a different man of the cloth than a lot of people had met before. And they respected this man who defended what he believed and was not afraid to stand up and to hold his own against those who did not like his particular beliefs. Another time, this was told by a missionary companion of his, where he is confronted by a mob, and the mob says, show us a sign, show us a sign. And Willard looks back at him and says, I've got a new companion, and he's not used to these kinds of things. Would it be okay if we just sent him down the road a ways, and then I'll give you a sign? And so he sends his junior companion down the road about a quarter mile, and when he sees he's out there a ways, he looks back at the leader of the mob and says, "All right, I'll give you a sign. I will strike you blind, and with one quick second, with a left jab to one eye and a right cross to the other eye." The man reels back and falls on the ground, and Willard takes off running towards his companion as fast as he can go. He approaches his companion. He says, "Run, Elder, run." And they ran, and they outran the mob. And that was a story by one of his companions. Lots of fun things that probably aren't as fun when they're happening. But as we look back at it, is one that we can see Willard just enjoying immensely as these kinds of things happened on his mission and there in the southern states and also to New York later on.
So perhaps as just a little more background as to why he was so good at boxing, Vicki, can you tell us what road brought him to being so great at this sport?
I don't know what the answer to that would be, do you?
Where did he start boxing? Where did his career take him before?
I know he was always winning. I can tell you that. I'm trying to recall things that I've read and seen. My dad had a scrapbook just of tons of newspaper articles about Grandpa, mostly about his fighting career, and they've got that all bound up to be preserved now, and my brother has that. He would just always win. There was something about him. I think he was just exceptionally agile and could maybe bounce around a lot. There was the boxing exhibition in the in Palmyra. I don't know if you want that story just yet. Do you?
Perhaps we can start back at Brigham Young Academy, where he actually may have got a start in boxing.
Yeah, I don't know exactly either. He was a coach, and we have pictures, of course, of him there with BYU Academy across it, and he has his wrestling team there, and other pictures of him with boxing gloves and the Indian clubs and so forth. A very athletic individual. I think part of it stems back from his own personal creed about what he felt about himself and about the body that God had blessed him with. Perhaps I can read his creed. Would that be?
Sure.
Let me just read this to you because it exemplifies Willard and his feelings about being fit and taking care of yourself. He said, "This is my creed. When the body was entrusted to my care, it was perfectly organized. I am supposed to keep it free from all contamination, to keep it pure and undefiled, to uniformly develop my faculties and all parts of my body to their highest capacity, that I may eventually bring my entire body to a symmetrical shape and the highest stage of development, approaching as nearly as possible that which God designed it, a perfect specimen of manhood in the image of my Maker, filling nature's measurements. There is rightly a law against carrying pistols or other deadly weapons, but there is no law against carrying science with nature's weapons to defend yourself against insolent aggression." And so that kind of permeated his entire life by way of keeping himself fit and being able to defend himself. And so he became that kind of person and taught people how to defend themselves. And even in his time as an athlete, as a boxer, and becomes a professional boxer with the blessing and the approval of the brethren, as he asks them first, you know, "Is it okay for me to become a professional boxer?" He just enjoyed the sport and enjoyed defending himself and matching his skills against others. And he was very, very good. As
I understand it, he had a national championship of some type. Can you?
I think at the turn of the century, I'm told he was the middleweight boxing champion. He also taught Jack Dempsey how to box. For those who remember Jack Dempsey, he became a very famous boxer.
He beat Bob Douglas, who was the middleweight champion of the United States there in St. Louis. And he was the top athlete, according to one individual, here in the state of Utah for many years. And so he He loved athletics and loved sports and loved putting his and matching his skills against others.
Another good reason why the brethren knew what they were doing when they sent he and Rebecca to Palmyra. Very interesting. Let's go back to Palmyra now a little bit. Your mother was baptized in kind of a special place on a special date. Can you tell me a little bit about that, Rand?
Yes, it was nearing the time of the 100-year anniversary of Moroni's visit to the Prophet Joseph Smith in 1823 in September. And so Heber J. Grant and others were planning to come for a big missionary conference and a big celebration there at the Hill Cumorah. And just 7 days before they arrived, the deal was sealed with the Inglis farm, which Willard had been negotiating with James Inglis, who owned part of the Hill Cumorah. And so 7 days before that was sealed, which allowed the church to own at least a portion of the Hill Cumorah. And they were able to then climb the hill and be on the hill for part of the celebration. And it was a marvelous time. And great things happened. All the missionaries came marching in. The brethren, all the elders came marching on foot, and the sisters came by whatever means of transportation they could come. And a great conference was held for a few days there in Palmyra, there at the Hill Cumorah and in the Sacred Grove. At the end of the day there at the Hill Cumorah, they came from the Hill Cumorah back to the Joseph Smith farm, where Palmyra had just recently had her eighth birthday and was ready to be baptized a member of the church. Willard had dammed up, as they did in the days of Joseph Smith, Hathaway Brook there, where some of the early members of the church were baptized, and had made a pool there sufficient in depth that one could be baptized. And there, with missionaries and with general authorities, Willard baptized his daughter Palmyra, as her dear friend Genevieve Morgan was watching on the side there, waiting herself to be baptized. And Willard baptized Palmyra, and when Palmyra came up out of the water, little Genevieve, all dressed in white, took off running. And she was so afraid of water, and was just it was just more than she could even comprehend. And so she went out, and I asked my mother, where did she go? And she said she went out into the cars, where all the cars were parked out there, these old cars, and she hid herself amongst the cars. And so it was nearly 2 years later, when she had overcome her fear of water, that she was baptized into the church. They later went on to be missionary companions there in the eastern states, and even up until their death, just within the past years, they carried on communication together back and forth, and were dear friends the rest of their life. But that was a very special occasion. And then following the baptism, Rebecca and Willard had already always had a great fondness with James E. Talmage. And Rebecca wanted James E. Talmage to confirm Palmyra. And as she talked with him, she says, well, he said to her, I'm not in charge of the baptismal service. President Grant is, but I let you and me pray about it, and we'll see what happens. And so they prayed about it. And when it was announced that Palmyra would be confirmed, it was announced that she would be confirmed by James E. Talmage. And he arose and walked past Rebecca, and they smiled at each other and recognized that their prayer had been answered. And James E. Talmage then confirmed Palmyra a member of the church.
What a great story. Now, there were others in this very same creek who were baptized later. Vicki, can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, my dad told me that when they would have these baptisms, and everybody was baptized there in those days, you know, the new converts and of course, the grandma and grandpa's children, all four of them, Dad said that they would dam up the creek several days ahead so it would create a big enough pool for people to be baptized in. And he said when you walked in, then you'd sink into mud up above your ankles. So he did tell me that, you know, then you have to wait for the sediment to kind of, you know, so that the water would be a little clearer before you could actually baptize somebody. But he said nobody's toes came up out of the water when they baptized him in the creek.
When the church did the first pageant back in Palmyra and the Hill Cumorah, I understand that your father, Alvin, played the young Joseph Smith. Tell me that story.
He did. There was a sister missionary there, Norma Fairbanks, who wrote what kind of became the forerunner of the pageants back there. And this was to be held in the Sacred Grove. Well, there weren't too many members of the church there who were even close to the age of the prophet Joseph Smith when he had his first vision. So my dad was 9, and they asked him to play the part. And he said, well, I'll have to think about that. And of course, his mother said, well, why do you have to think about that? It's such an honor to be asked to do that. And he just kept saying, well, I'll have to think about that. Well, B.H. Roberts was my dad's favorite visitor to the farm, and he was there at this time. And so he got my dad and sat down, had a little chat. And Dad had to admit that he was afraid he would have to see an angel, and he just didn't know how he would react to that. So Elder Roberts assured him that that was not going to happen, and so Dad took the part, and all was well.
So they've been here for a while in Palmyra trying to make friends, trying to gain property for the church. They're making some headway. What actually finally broke the ice that the Beans were able to become part of the community and be accepted? Rand, can you tell me?
Oh, I'd have to say probably it was a growing number of things. It took some time and some patience on the part of the Beans as they gradually made their way and established themselves. People soon learned that he was a great scriptorian and he knew the scriptures, and that he seemed to know the scriptures better than their ministers did and their Sunday school teachers and everybody else. And since there was no LDS church, of course, in the area at the time. Just they met together as just a family at the beginning, but they were invited at times to other religions, and they would go and attend those other churches. And then as they would come to the end of Sunday school classes and so forth, many times the teachers would say, Willard, would you like to add anything to this lesson? And he would expound and bring in some other great insights and truths that they did not have and understand. And people began to say that, they believe a lot of things like we believe, too, and they're not such bad people. And they were invited to different socials at times, and though many people still shunned them, there was a growing number of people that began to make friends with them. And one of the things that Vicki has been in the one opera hall. Do you want to tell that story, Vicki?
I could tell her. You could tell it, but yeah,
you were there, so tell it.
I will say that I had the opportunity. In 2000, we had about 28 of us being family members went back to Palmyra with my dad. And my sister Lori's husband, Matt, took a video of my dad and all of the church historical sites. We wanted to get, the goal for me personally was to get everything out of my dad's head, so we would have that, be able to preserve all of that forevermore. And we were over at the park there on Main Street one day, and Dad pointed across the street and said, that building over there, that's the old opera house where his dad had had this boxing exhibition. Well, I'd heard about this boxing exhibition for 100 years, and I was so excited. And my brother Bart and I ran across the street and to see if we could actually get in there. And actually, it had turned into the police station now, but they said the upstairs was where the opera house was. And so I said, can we go up there? And he said, it's just a storage area now, but we did get to go up and see the stage where that boxing ring would have been put up. So that was very exciting to me to see this place and have a vision in my head of where this took place. So there was this boxing exhibition. I don't know which, Rand or I could probably both tell it. He might do a little better
job.
Tell
about the three rows of people.
Well, what Grandpa did, because they'd been there for a number of years now, and making friends was such a slow process. And he thought, well, people, even if they don't like you, they always appreciate a good athlete. So he decided to put on this boxing exhibition. And he put out flyers everywhere, just inviting anybody who wanted to come and fight him. And, of course, you know, a lot of people thought, well, this is a great opportunity, smack down this Mormon, you know, that they didn't care for. So the day of this exhibition comes, and the first three rows had the biggest bruisers in town, in several towns probably. So they're all there waiting for their opportunity in the ring. So Grandpa's in there, and the first guy goes in, and he goes into the ring, and I think it was one blow from Grandpa, and the guy was out cold, and they carried him out, and the next guy came in, and, you know, the same thing was repeated. Nobody lasted more than 15 seconds. To make it even more embarrassing, Grandpa was such an athlete that he was doing backflips in the ring while they were carrying the last guy out. Well, after he'd had this experience with about seven of them, the eighth guy declined the invitation to come in the ring with him. So at that point, Grandpa took a piece of chalk and drew a 2-foot circle around himself and invited anybody there to come and try to push him out of the circle. Well, many tried, but nobody was able to do that. But I think that experience, well, people just gained a whole new respect for this guy. And he became, I want to say, somewhat of a normal guy. I mean, that wasn't exactly normal that he had the ability to do that. But still, he wasn't just a preacher. People liked him. If they said that kind of broke the ice. They felt like there was great headway after that experience.
There's also a First Relief Society that was organized sometime that helped in this ice-breaking process as well. Can you tell me about
that? Yeah. The First Relief Society was established in 1925, the first branch, and Sunday school weren't until 1926. So that was kind of the first thing that happened, and Grandma was the president of that First Relief Society. She worked with the county poor master, and he's the guy who tried to kind of keep up with all the needs of the community. And pretty soon he said, well, Rebecca, you keep up with this better than I do, so you can have anything you want. And he'd give her entire bolts of material and stuff to make layettes for the new babies being born and so on. So they established a real good relationship there. And clearly Grandma was working in the community long before the church was ever really established there, before the first branch came.
There's also a Rand Lions Club recognition. Do you know about that?
I know particularly as they left, they were recognized for a couple of weeks prior to their leaving. And I know at one of the conventions, I'm not sure if this is the one you're referring to, but where they were having a huge banquet, and Willard and Rebecca were sitting down in the where all the people were sitting, and they had a special table of guests up for all the ministers and their wives, special area for them to sit up front, and Willard was not up there. And so one of the ministers was asked to come down and speak to Willard and say, Willard, we want you and Rebecca to come up and sit at our table with the rest of the ministers. Willard said, I'm perfectly comfortable sitting down here. We're just fine. He says, no, we want you to come up and to sit with us. And so over those years, that in and of itself was almost a miracle because of the great hatred and the many debates and so forth, and the bad feelings that were involved as some of the churches hired others to come in and speak against the church. Now at this particular point, with Willard defending himself and defending the church and being there and becoming a member of the community and being part of the Lions Club and all of this kind of thing, they now respected and he was one of them. They became part of the community, and to have a Mormon and his wife sit with the rest of the Christian ministers at a table up front for all to see and recognize was truly a wonderful thing, and a great progress that had been made from a sheer hatred to now acceptance and even people enjoying and liking them
right.
For a change.
So we know a big part of their reason for being there was to purchase lands and sites and whatever that the church was interested in. What effect did that have on the community, their reaction as to that reason for them being there, either one of you?
One of the things that Willard was so good at was making friends, and he knew how to make friends, and he knew what friends to make. And when he first arrived in Palmyra, one of the very first friends that he made was a man by the name of Plenty T. Sexton. And as he held street meetings and there was great traffic jams, the police didn't want them to hold the meetings in the streets. So Pliny T. Sexton gives them a little park to meet in where they can have their street meetings. And he establishes a real good friendship with Pliny T. Sexton, who owns a major part of the Hill Cumorah. They become great friends. He also establishes a great friendship with a lawyer who later becomes the chief executor of the estate of Sexton after he dies, by the name of C.C. Congdon. They become good friends. And a man by the name of S.N. Sawyer, another attorney, another lawyer in the area, they become great friends. And he establishes friendships with key people in the community and without being overbearing in any way by way of religion. And they take a hankering to him. They like this man. Pliny T. Sexton and Willard, we have pictures in our family photos, do we not, Vicki, of Pliny T. Sexton holding Alvin and Palmyra in his arms and him showing one of the first uncut editions of the Book of Mormon to Willard. And he wanted to sell Hill Cumorah to the church for $100,000, which was a fortune in those days. And the church did not have that kind of money to buy the hill for that. And so Willard and the church authorities, of course, refused that. But they just continued their friendship, and as the years went along, and finally when Pliny T. Sexton is about ready to die and is there in the upper story of his bank there in Palmyra, Willard decides to move his street meetings over underneath the window of Pliny T. Sexton, so he'd be able to hear some of the sermons, and so he could teach him the gospel before he died. And one of the nurses said that was caring for Pliny T. Sexton that he said to her, he had never heard the gospel preached so plainly in all of his life as he did from Willard Bean beneath his window there. And so these kinds of friendships that he established paved the way so when the time was right for the Lord, for the church to gain repossession of the Hill Cumorah, then there were friends in place to be of assistance. And I think the major friend in all of that was the attorney C.C. Congdon, who called Willard after Sexton's death and after all the heirs were meeting in a meeting. And he called Willard and said, "Come to my office. You need to come when no one's here because we need to talk." So Willard came to the office of Pliny T. Sexton and, of C.C. Congdon, and they talked. And he says, "I think we can put together a little package here that the heirs of the Sexton estate will agree to, which will allow you to gain possession of the Hill Cumorah." And so they pull that together, they put some things together, and the heirs wanted at least $50,000 for the Hill Cumorah. They did some little figuring there, and finally with that in the Grange Hall and some other bits of land there around Cumorah, it came to $53,000. C.C. Congdon presented that to the family heirs. There was no objection. They signed it, and the communications between Salt Lake and Willard were kind of a very inspirational type of event that happened. The letters kind of passing in the night, Willard having done what the brethren were asking him to do. And they point that out in one of their letters that they noticed with singular coincidence how that had all been brought together, probably writing their letters at the same time. And then the church then took possession of the Hill Cumorah, which is something that brought great joy and happiness to Willard and his ministry there. What did I forget, Vicki? Anything to add to that?
Oh, you handled that very well.
Do.
Grandpa did then also, he was able to purchase the Martin Harris home on the Peter Whitmer farm later, and so kind of tying together all of the church properties back there for the church, which was just a wonderful thing.
So having laid the groundwork so many years previous to this, the church is finally now built the Palmyra Temple just in recent years. And Vicki, as I understand, you were given an invitation to be there specifically. Tell us about that.
That was just a wonderful thing. My dad and Rand's mother were being the only two living members, of the Bean family that lived there. They were both invited, and my sister Lori and I got to go with my dad, and Rand's two sisters, Pam and Pat, went with Aunt Palmyra. And Yeah, and we got to go, and it was just wonderful. In the session that we were in, the dedicatory session, President Hinckley talked to both my dad and Pal in there, and he told the story of the boxing exhibition. That's the story that he shared in that particular session, and it was just a thrill for us to be there, April 6th, 2000. And, you know, the other thing that my sister and I went to dinner with my dad, I guess the night before the dedication, and we were thinking that Joseph Smith, the Saints, had left Palmyra 84 years prior to when Grandpa went there in 1915. I mean, there's about an 84-year span. And then from the time Grandpa got there to the time that the temple was dedicated was another 84, 85 years, just about the same time period on both sides.
Very
we just thought that was just kind of a fun thing.
So for me, this seems to be a story more about friendship than about boxing. I mean, we have the book that you entitled The Fighting Parson, but that was just, it seems, one of his tools. What can we learn from the Willard and Rebecca Bean story?
He was called the Fighting Parson by many people before I used it, you know, as the title of my book, and that's why I used it that way. You know, there are many ways to do missionary work, and that's when I think of Grandma and Grandpa back there. I mean, sometimes all you've got is to be kind. That's all they had. They couldn't certainly go back there and start preaching the gospel. That wasn't going to work in that day and time. And so I look at their life back there and realize that how important it is for people just to be kind to others, to set some kind of example that others can look at and say, well, I want to be like that, you know. And I've thought about that a lot. I also think about preparation for missions in our lives that we certainly don't anticipate. But Grandpa was definitely, you know, he had experience after experience that prepared him for a very difficult mission in Palmyra, and one that I want to say only he could have accomplished. You know, I'm sure that's not exactly true. Somebody else could have been raised up for that job, but Grandpa had all the skills already in place to be able to handle that particular mission. And for me, the reason I wrote that I compiled Willard Bean, the Fighting Parson, was because I have seven children. And I wanted them. I had all of these things. I just kind of gathered all my life, you know, pictures and you know, his autobiography. Thank goodness he wrote that. He did enjoy writing, and I'm very grateful that he wrote that, and journals and so on. And I thought, I've got to save all these things in one place for my children, or they'll never, you know, they're not going to go through all my files. So I put that together. But it didn't take long before I realized there's just so much more. And so when we moved up here to Utah, I was living in California when I put together that first book, but kind of wondered why I was moving to Utah when we did it. And I really believe the reason was, is this is where all the information was. I could go to church archives, and they had just lots of stuff and lots of letters, communications. I found George Albert Smith's papers. That was at the University of Utah's, you know, in their special collections. And so I could go through all of those, and there was just a lot of letters back and forth. So I don't know. I think things just kind of come together where you can, and I, you know, Rand and I both have just this grand heritage, you know, and faith promoting. And certainly I want to pass that down to all of my children. I just had a grandbaby. Well, like I said, I've got another grandbaby being born day after tomorrow, but one that was born about 4 months ago. They wanted to use a family name. This is my son's little girl. So Jim called me and said, we've named our baby. We decided to name her Ivy Bean. The last name is Zimmerman for them. And I thought I had misunderstood, you know. He said, Mom, your maiden name, we're naming her Ivy Bean Zimmerman. I thought, wow, you know, I will teach that child so she understands the importance of that name that she has just inherited. And the little two-year-old boy always tells everybody her name, Ivy Bean, Ivy Bean. Oh, it's just so cute, you know. So they get the idea that that this is just a marvel of heritage that we've been blessed with.
It's obvious that you too and your entire family appreciate and really honor your heritage. And as someone from outside the family but very interested in the story and the heritage, how can the rest of us feel like we're part of the Bean family?
I think one of the overriding messages of the story of Willard and Rebecca, and Vicki used the term raised up. I think David Boone wrote an article on Willard being called a man raised up. And that's what the Lord does essentially to all of us. It doesn't matter which family we belong to. He raises us up to handle situations. We're all raised up if we will accept the raising up and the destiny that is ours to accomplish the work of the Lord here in the latter days. And so in our own families, in our own situations, regardless of country or heritage or culture in which we live in the church, we are literally, as a people, raised up to accomplish certain things that the work of the Lord can go forth throughout the world. And so I think that's one of the things I learned specifically from Willard and Rebecca, is that it's not a bloodline thing, though we are blessed and fortunate to have his blood and Rebecca's rolling through our veins. But it is more than that. It is all of us have that heritage if we will accept it and to go forth in these days. And the other point, I think, too, that everyone can learn from this story is the power of love, even in the face of hatred. And the Savior's teachings really do work when he says to love your enemies. When they went back to Palmyra, New York, they were surrounded by enemies. They had no friends anywhere. And little Palmyra would come running in the house and up the stairs and cry her heart out at age 6 because she had no friends. And Rebecca had no friends except those from Salt Lake that would come at the beginning. But they did not cease to love. They refused to hate back when everybody hated them. And as they continued to love the people and love those that they worked with and love those that hated them, over the years that hatred melted away to where by the time they left, they were writing letters to Salt Lake wondering if the brethren had made a mistake because they didn't want the Beans to leave. They wanted them to stay there and they'd become such a vital part of the community. They had fallen in love with the Beans and all because I think Will and Rebecca refused to hate but decided to love as the Savior instructs us always to do. And it had great power.
Thank you.
Can I make one comment?
Please.
About when they left? You know, how many years?
25.
Thank you. After about 25 years, they received word from Salt Lake that they were to be released. That was in 1939. And like Rand was saying, one of the men, they were trying to kind of keep it a secret, and they just kind of slip away. But the people got wind of it, and somebody came up to Grandma and said that the Mormon Church is making a big mistake by taking you away from here. And she said later, she said, well, they just didn't understand the temporary nature of mission calls. I thought that was funny. I mean, after, you know, nearly 25 years, nobody considers that temporary. But the Lions Club had this wonderful dinner and, you know, entertainment and all this for them the night before they left. And if I could, I'd like to read what he said in tribute to them.
Yes.
The MC said this. He said, we're doing honor to a family that came to Palmyra some years ago. When they settled on the Joseph Smith farm, some of our super pious citizens started a tirade with the object of getting rid of them. But as they proved themselves good citizens, we soon learned to tolerate them. Then we learned to admire them and respect them. And now we love them. It is with reluctance that we now bid farewell to the most versatile family that ever lived in Wayne County. Thought that was a sweet parting message for them.
A very amazing tribute from where it started to how it ended. As Rand mentioned, we all in the church all have a purpose and all are working toward our goals as children of our Heavenly Father. Some of the records that you were able to find that helped you compile these histories of your grandfather became very invaluable in helping you do what you needed to do. We're all going to be Willard Beans to our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren someday, what can we do as far as records and so forth to help in that?
I'll tell you what I've told my children and everybody that I have an opportunity to say it to is to start young. When I was 21 and working a job that didn't keep me busy all the time, I was sitting at a typewriter and I thought, well, I'll use my extra time to start my life story. And so I did. And I know that much that I wrote then I would never remember now at the age I am now. So I was really glad I started then. And that's why I tell my kids, just start writing some things down because you're not going to remember them later. And then to just keep up with it, I finished, shall we say, my life story at the age of 50. I figure I call that my first half of my life. And then I figure everything from now on I can just take straight out of my journal. But I'm a big believer in life stories. And certainly if Grandpa hadn't done that for us, we would have just lost so much. And most of us feel like our lives really aren't that interesting, but they will be to our grandchildren. Our kids might not find them interesting, but our grandchildren might too.
I think as both of us have buried our parents, as it were, and cleaned out their house and their possessions, it has been a fascination to us and a treasure to us, all of the things that they kept and the things that they wrote down especially. And having the autobiography of Willard and Rebecca and that he wrote in the latter part of his life mainly and having those preserved and in our possessions and seeing all that they wrote about, so much of what we know about that particular part of church history is because of the notes and the experiences of Willard and Rebecca Bean and the church going back to the, otherwise we wouldn't have very much knowledge of that. And they wrote it down, as Vicki mentioned, and that ought to be a lesson to all of us. I have become a better journal keeper because of what I have read from Willard and Rebecca Bean, just knowing that how precious that is to me and to my posterity. There might be some word or sentence in my life that might be of help if I'll just have the sense to write it down and preserve it so that someone can read it someday and they might tie it all back to the glorious missionary work of Willard and Rebecca Bean and the heritage that they have.
So perhaps in the vernacular of world-famous boxer Willard Bean, do you have any parting shots?
I wish, you know, we talk a lot about Willard, and sometimes Rebecca kind of gets moved off to the side a little bit because he's the more colorful individual. But they were a wonderful match, and she made up some areas of deficiency of his that only she could do, a very spiritual woman. And she was as much a part of this, if not more so, than Willard was. And I would hope that everyone might, when we think of Willard Bean, that we might also think of Rebecca Bean and the magnificent Bean raised up person that she was to be a partner with him back there in that area, because her contributions, maybe not so much on the physical side and the boxing side that we know happened with great excitement and interest, but with her great spiritual insight and comfort and spiritual experiences that are precious beyond even mentioning in our records, in our history. She was ever so much a part of this, and she should not be forgotten in any way, and I hope that is always remembered too.
Yes, that made me think of when she was a young girl living in Denmark. Her parents joined the church, and they had the missionaries come to their home. And she said once that she had a feeling deep down in her heart that she hoped that someday she could have missionaries come to her home too. Well, and then she had to say, after this experience in Palmyra, she never could have guessed that she'd have more missionaries in her home than any other woman in the church. Because the missionaries, the brethren from Salt Lake, everybody loved to go back there. And she would feed them. She made, I don't know how many millions of meals, you know, for all of these visitors and find them a comfortable place to sleep. And I know that the boys, my dad and his brothers and missionaries too, I think would sleep in the barn often, you know, on the hay out there so that the brethren from Salt Lake could have the bedrooms in the house. And yeah, she had to run a house under those circumstances. It wasn't very easy. There was a lot of work there for her to do.
Well, okay. Thank you very much. We've been visiting with Vicki Bean Topliff and Rand Packer, grandchildren of Willard and Rebecca Bean. Thank you very much.
Thank you.